This is The Think Tank, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. With Dr. Mike O'Neill and hosted by Mike Russell. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, one guest this time, John Shadegg, former congressman from Arizona, and I must say, probably one of the most astute observers of the political scene. That's why he's here. That's why he's here alone. I'm sure we'll have no trouble filling this hour. I want to ask a question, both literally and figuratively. This is not your father's Republican Party, is it?
Oh, no, this is definitely not my father's Republican Party.
Contrast. I mean, you came into Congress with the Gingrich Revolution, 95. Contrast that with the Tea Party and the current situation.
Well, there are parallels and there are dissimilarities. I think, and maybe I'm biased, but I think the class of 94 was made up of kind of pretty mainstream Republicans, not radically too more conservative than most of the party. But I think they were elected by people who were fed up with a Washington that didn't get anything done. And I think they were fed up with a Congress that had been controlled by the Democrats for 40 years and had set a lot of bad policies. So we were very, very anxious for change. I think, by and large, we were pretty astute politically. We had some people that had been former staffers and kind of knew the game, but we were not patient. So we went in there and wanted change, and we wanted it now.
Hope and change, it sounds like. Yeah,
here we go with that. It was not hope and change.
It was not hope and change.
Thank you.
But we did have hope, and we did want change. Hey, we wrote a contract saying how we would change America.
A brilliant piece of marketing.
Absolutely. And then when our leaders began to not live up to that contract, we became frustrated and rebellious, and I think made a lot of people in America happy with our rebellion. What we didn't understand is how difficult the institution was to change. And I think to his credit, one of the guys that expressed it best was now Congressman again, Matt Salmon, who said, we discovered it's difficult to turn around a battleship in a canal. And this was a battleship that had been going in the wrong direction, or maybe he said aircraft carrier that had been going in the wrong direction, but turning it around in that circumstance wasn't easy. Today's Tea Party group is a completely different group in the sense that they are every bit as frustrated, but nowhere near as sophisticated. And they know they want things different, but they haven't spent their lives kind of watching how to do that and figured out kind of an astute or pragmatic or practical path to get it done.
So I think it was, and you look at the Tea Party, I think it was the Republicans that it was a bad move. They co-opted the Tea Party is what they've done, it seems to be. And now that part of the Republican Party is the wacko fringe that has been labeled by the Democrats, and successfully so, by the way, has made all of the Tea Partiers look like right-wing whack jobs. And here they are still swimming in the same Republican pool. Is that the Republicans' fault? Did the Republican Party invite them in and co-opt them?
Well, first of all, since political parties define themselves, you can neither invite them in nor exclude them. I suppose you could say that some leaders of the Republican Party are trying to say there's no room in the party for that group. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a mistake. By the same token, they have insisted upon being leaderless, and whether they were invited in or not, many of their views parallel those of the party: smaller government, lower taxes, an American foreign policy that looks out for America and is essential to world peace. To the extent that they are less sophisticated politically, they have not spent years going to political meetings. They have not studied elections. They have not carefully kind of looked at history. They just don't
know how the sausage is made.
Right. They just kind of jump in and demand solutions.
Right.
And, oh, by the way, say, we don't have a leader, but by God, we want these solutions. That has caused a problem. But the fun part is, and we need to get there at some point, you can now see that the progressive movement in the Democratic Party is beginning to assert itself. And I would argue Elizabeth Warren is as far out of touch as anybody on the right.
Amen.
I picked up on that one thing, leaderless, and that may be an interesting point of distinction. 1994, 1995, there seemed to be a record. Well, Newt Gingrich was their guy. Right now, if you talk about Tea Party, who's the head? There are a multiplicity of voices, and it's hard to communicate singularly without a single leader.
Absolutely.
And it's surely not John Boehner.
No. It is definitely John Boehner is definitely not the kind of the single leader of the Republican Party, and his disdain for the Tea Party crowd is pretty clear.
Well, the other,
and I think that's a crowd. I think that's a distinction to be made. The Tea Party is a crowd.
It's a crowd.
It's not a party. So it's running around without a head because it's not an organized group.
And in a way, unlike, and we talked about this a little earlier, kind of going into my history. It's a group that formed over a sense of frustration, not behind a leader. The Goldwater movement in 1964 was a struggle between the kind of the middle of the Republican Party or the establishment Republican Party and the conservatives. But the movement formed around a leader, and people were drawn to Barry Goldwater and what he said and wrote, what he wrote in Conscience of a Conservative, what he wrote in his column, Where Do You Stand, Sir? The views he expressed drew people to him, and that gave them kind of a coalesced behind, okay, we know what that group is. They believe in these conservative principles. It's hard to figure out what the Tea Party believes. Where is the Tea Party on immigration reform? Well, some of them are passionately against it. They are nativists who see any immigrant as a real threat, but some of them don't. Some of them are free market conservatives who recognize that this economy needs immigrant labor and that as a nation, we need to grow to support our population. And so they don't have that same kind of blind opposition labeling everything in the world as amnesty.
I think we just set the agenda for when we come back. I would like to explore with you what I think are the two elements of the current right in the Republican Party. We've got the economic conservatives.
Right.
We have the social conservatives.
Right.
And sometimes it's a big happy tent, but every once in a while, those seams get busted and it becomes clear that there are at least two different strains
of the
Republican
Party. Absolutely.
Right.
That's right. All right. We're here with John Shattuck. More in the Think Tank right here on KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with John Shattuck discussing the future of the Republican Party. I want to set this up with a reference to a real interesting old article Barry Goldwater wrote in 1962, envisioning the future of Arizona 50 years hence, which is now 2 years ago. And among the points that he raised in terms of what he would like to see in Arizona was, and I quote, open borders with Mexico. That's not current Republican doctrine, or at least not amongst all of the most, I think, of the Republican Party. Would Barry be at home in today's Republican Party, or where would he fit into the spectrum?
I guess there are several points you have to make. Number one, which Barry Goldwater, the 1962 Barry Goldwater or the Barry Goldwater after Peggy passed away at the end of his career and he had remarried? They're very different Barry Goldwaters. But one Barry Goldwater would not have changed, and that's the idea of open borders. I think that Goldwater followed Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman believes in free trade.
It's the economic plank of the Republican Party.
Absolutely. And I think he grew up largely in Arizona. And I think he had an understanding of the influence of the Hispanic culture here. And I think he would be very, very uncomfortable with today's nativists who say anyone from outside the country, anyone who wants to come here is a threat to the nation. And that's kind of the line that's out there. As a matter of fact, I read an article yesterday that said that somebody was going to challenge John McCain, and they cited as the most recent failure or breach of conservative orthodoxy that McCain had committed is that he had supported a guest worker program. Well, I got a flash. Lots and lots and lots and lots of us believe a guest worker program is, in fact, the only way you will ultimately secure the border.
Yes.
If you look back at the Bracero program, prior to the Bracero program, and I don't know if people understand it, it was a program that allowed Mexican workers to come into
that
the United States.
That was in the 50s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Mm-hmm. Late 50s, early 60s. Mm-hmm. Organized labor allowed it to happen. And then when they discovered what was happening, I think without any sophistication as to what it was doing, but perhaps with a long-term fear of what it might do, though I don't think it would have, they opposed it. But prior to the implementation of the Bracero program, there were 1 million illegal immigrants crossing every year. There's a graph out there that I can produce for anybody that wants to see it that shows that when the program was implemented, which allowed people to cross legally, they didn't get citizenship, they were just allowed to come across and work in this economy, most worked in agriculture, the number of crossings dropped from 1 million a year to 35,000 a year.
Basically suggesting those people came for jobs.
They came for work. Mm-hmm. You know, I've told people, look, if I couldn't survive and support my family, which is what we all want to do, and oh, by the way, the Constitution makes these guarantees, sets the goals, at least the Declaration of Independence, for all people, not just Americans. If I couldn't support my family in a socialist economy or a corrupt economy, I'd come to the United States. I think most of them who do come here don't want to stay forever. We used to have circular migration. They'd come across, work for a while, send money back. They'd go home for the holidays.
Come here when there's work. Come in the work season.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in any event, then when the Bracero program was repealed, the number of illegal crossings skyrocketed back almost immediately to over 1 million a year. I think you study people, the human instinct is to yearn for freedom. It's to yearn not to take a handout from government or from anyone, but to produce for yourself, to succeed as best you can, to support your family, and to live the life you envision. And if we think that walls are going to stop that, then we fail to recognize history. The Berlin Wall didn't stop it, and no other will. You said most people don't support immigration. Most Republicans don't support immigration reform. I think that's wrong.
I agree.
The vast majority of Republicans support immigration reform. The survey data all shows that. What you find is that politicians are afraid of a loud minority. And I talked to many, many, many Republicans in the U.S. House last year about this issue, and they would all say, look, I'm ready to vote for a bill. I don't like the Senate bill, but I'm ready to vote for a bill because the current system isn't working. And they recognize when you say the current system isn't working, that means the border isn't secure, which means that, yeah, illegal workers can cross, but it also means bad actors can cross. For that matter, I try to warn people what that means is radical Muslims, Islamic terrorists can cross because we fail to secure our border. But what those politicians would say, yeah, I want to vote for it, but I'm standing for election in 2 months, and I don't want to go into an audience of 100 people and have five of them screaming at me saying how wrong I am and how evil I am, influencing the other 95. And that's what we have on that issue.
I think because they've done such a good job of vilifying the people that are crossing and making the illegals, the evil illegals that are coming over, instead of the bad guy in this whole thing is our immigration system.
Absolutely.
The villain is the immigration.
The very language, when you use the word illegal, we are a law-abiding people. We are against illegals. Anything.
Right.
Because people have the innate sense, listen, I follow the rules, so.
Well, it's respect for law. One of the things I do, I hope this isn't too far off topic, but when I'm in a cab in Washington and I'm there 2 weeks a month, unless I have work I have to do, I ask the cabbie where they're from, and I ask them if they're happy here. I ask them if they're U.S. citizens, and I ask them the difference between America and where they came from. And the vast majority will identify where they came from. The vast majority will say, yes, I've become a citizen because they've been here quite a while. But when you start to probe them, they will either tell you what was wrong in their country was there were no rules, or that what was wrong in their country was the rules didn't apply to the wealthy. They didn't apply equally to everybody. They didn't apply to you. The rules applied to you unless you had a friend that was controlling the government. And many of them, actually more than you would be surprised, say, well, the difference in America is the rule of law. And they'll say, here, you know, I can work full-time driving a cab and still go to school and get a job, and they'll brag to me about how great this country is because of the rule of law.
Because if I go out and I earn some money and I stash it away, I get to keep it.
I get to keep it,
as opposed to you have something and you fall out of political favor and basically everything you have is gone.
I have the right to get a job here, which back in my country, I couldn't do.
Which is
I couldn't get a good job.
Billions of dollars are flowing into this country from people who've made money elsewhere because they know once it crosses the borders into here, it's fundamentally safe from confiscation.
So we should be passionate about people abiding by the law, and we shouldn't be thrilled with people that cross illegally, and we shouldn't say to them, look, we're just going to forget it. It's no big deal. But that doesn't mean we need to put them on box cars and ship them back.
But when I hear in this debate, however, somebody say, well, first secure the border, undefined, and then we can do it, what I'm really hearing is never.
Never is exactly right.
Because it's a 3,000-mile border. I mean, they couldn't – the Russians couldn't secure Berlin.
But
that was
– what they don't tell you is what they mean by secure the border is a wall through which nobody can come illegally or legally. Ronald Reagan, I believe, said, if there must be walls, let there be big gates. The reality is, if there are millions of American employers who want workers, and in many cases who can't find workers who will do the menial jobs involved of washing dishes, cleaning hotel rooms, picking crops, mucking out horse stalls, if those people are here and want to hire them, and we create no lawful mechanism, and the employers can't find workers here, then they're going to cross illegally.
I can translate secure the border first, and that's simple. I'm up for re-election. They don't know what that means, but I'm up for re-election, and I have to say secure the border
first. But it is true that anybody that's up for election, no matter what they've said in the past, says in that year.
Yes. Exactly.
Secure the borders.
And this Congressman John Shattuck.
Or build the dang fence.
He's here with us. We'll build a fence over the break. We'll be back on the Think Tank.
The Think Tank. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Okay, we are back with former Congressman John Shattuck. And in the break, we were talking about really the sort of the intersection of national and local politics. And that intersection is John McCain. Running for re-election and interesting views within the Republican Party. He's taken some nasty hits from some circles. In your mind, how deep is that?
Very, very shallow. I mean, it is a handful of people who are angry and who choose to express their anger loudly and vociferously. But I don't think it's the broad sentiment. You know, people that rise to the level that John McCain has, who have not just national stature but world stature, are never going to agree with you on every issue. They're always going to do something that makes you mad. And like most of the things in life, you have to figure out, you know, it's a cost-benefit analysis. And I also think that, you know, respect and tolerance go a long way in life. The old line, everything I need to know in life I learned in kindergarten. I think a lot of people didn't do well in kindergarten. I think the people who are – view him in the most vicious or kind of visceral ways. Just
seems to be
they didn't do well in kindergarten.
Mentality is you either agree with me on 100% of things or else you're the enemy.
And that mentality persists in lots of places, and it really is a huge misunderstanding of politics, which is really human relations. You don't agree with your wife on everything. How are you going to agree with your political leaders on everything?
And if everybody likes you and everybody's agreeing with you, you're doing it wrong.
If you're 100%, you're probably talking platitudes that don't mean anything.
They once wrote about me in Washington that I think this was in the Almanac of American Politics, that I was – they talked about me ripping the Democrat Party over some issue, and then they said he was an equal opportunity – critic or something like that, and then related how all my criticism of the Republican Party. And in the course of my own political career, I had more criticism of the Republican Party than the Democrat Party. The Democrat Party was not going anywhere that I wanted the country to go, but the Republican Party was too hypocritical and too slow in pushing change. And so that drove me crazy. So I took plenty of shots. I think a lot of people would say Newt Gingrich made me the head of GOPAC due to the rubric keep your friends close and your enemies closer. He knew Shattuck was kind of the most aggressive, hardcore right winger in the freshman class, and he needed to have me close.
You know, nice. I'm thinking back to the 94-95 revolution, and in one way, it seems easier. That was easier for the Republicans than the current situation, in that you had a Democratic Party that was in control of everything for 40 years, which meant that they were fat, lazy, doing a lot of things complacently, and they were this big, fat, easy target. Now the Republicans have been control sort of half the time off and on, and so the target isn't as fat.
That's exactly right.
And a lot of the target's internal.
I mean, there were lots of things that were being done badly and lots of abuses. Chris Shays, who was the author of the legislation that said we needed to have all of the laws that apply to the country also apply to Congress. I mean, that was a huge target. The prior Congress had said, oh, no, we're above the law openly. Mm-hmm. And so Republicans were able to come in and say, no, we're not. We're the Congress. We represent the people. We're not above the law. So that was an example of
you get about 99% support on that. The other 1% are members of Congress.
Right, that's right.
I remember.
But we don't have near as big a target right now.
I mean, just in terms of.
Although Obama's a great target.
Complacency. I had a friend whose dad was. I was in college in the 70s and early 70s, and his dad was a congressional staffer. And I'm asked, well, what happens if the other party takes over? And he said, what? That's never going to happen. You know, it was beyond the conception.
Couldn't
the Democrats had been in more or less since FDR.
Right.
And this was, as everybody saw it, this was a permanent state of affairs.
Well, remember, the trouble that Newt got in was not what we did really in the first term, because in the first term, we cut congressional staff, we cut pay, we cut out a whole bunch of perks. It was that after we had power.
Those perks start to look better.
Yeah, no kidding. Suddenly Tom DeLay was saying, maybe we need some of that stuff back. And one of the ugliest fights was when kind of the leaders of the party in 1996, after we won the majority, started to take back the perks. And myself and Steve Largent and a lot of others stood up and said no.
Did you guys read Animal Farm?
Yeah, there you go. I remember a conference of Republicans where Newt ordered a mandatory conference. Everybody had to attend. And he got in there and he lectured us because the freshmen had brought down, or the then sophomores had brought down, a rule, which he was not happy about. And he just screamed up at us and said we were terrible and by God, we were all going to be punished and suffer. And Steve Largent went to the microphone and said, I've played professional football and I've had 280-pound tackles coming at me as fast as they could. And they couldn't intimidate me, Mr. Gingrich, and you can't either. And the place went kind of, whoa.
Yeah.
And then Lindsey Graham, who, think what you will about Lindsey Graham, he is a funny guy, went to the microphone next, and he turned to Newt and he said, well, you can intimidate me. And the place went nuts.
So in light of all of this, do you think we have any chance for any real governing in Washington in the next year?
I do. Not a lot in the next year. I think a fair amount of it all depends upon the president. I have been stunned, near speechless, over his reaction to the November election. This is the guy that stood up and said elections matter. And apparently believed it and thought he'd been endorsed and he could do exactly what he wanted. But when the nation clearly said, no, we're not going that way, we're not happy, when he announced, I may not be on the ballot, but my policies are, and those policies were trounced and his party was trounced, he steps forward and says, nothing's changed. We're going exactly where we want. And by the way, I have the same contempt for you in the Congress as I had before and the same willingness to disregard the law as I had before. So I think a lot of it depends upon him. One of the questions will be, does his conduct match his rhetoric? I think Republicans need to rise above his antagonistic rhetoric. I think they need to pass good legislation. And in my view, they need to stack it at the front door of the White House like cordwood. I think they should ignore.
Now, are we talking about legislation that's the product of legitimate compromise?
Yes.
Are we talking about stuff that's automatic?
No.
Stuff that could be passed now there's an automatic veto.
There's no point in passing fringe legislation or legislation that you can't get some bipartisan support for. And indeed, the process requires you to work on bills across the aisle, Republican and Democrat, find a consensus.
Especially you've got split
government. In real work across the aisle, not like the Democrats. Olympia Snowe was on board, so it's bipartisan. No,
right. Real substantive discussions. Yeah. And I think you can see that the split in the Democratic conference in the House is pretty obvious. Mrs. Pelosi represents the one crowd, and she's the supposed leader, but Mr. Hoyer represents a different group of people, and I think there are a whole bunch of them who are saying, hey, I don't want to follow that guy down at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. He's not headed where I want. Look at how fast that crowd of Democrats rejected the president's 509 proposal and said, we're not taking away college savings or beginning to tax college savings of millions of middle-class Americans. So there is the prospect that the president will listen and recognize that real compromise legislation is passing.
Is immigration one of those areas where that's
possible? I hope so.
It's certainly a big issue.
Here's my view of the future of the Republican Party. They need to decide that they will pay the price to govern. They need to take some risks, and they need to address some big issues. And
those risks are going to mean, if you're going to do compromise, that means there's going to be people on the Tea Party, and they're not going to be happy with
absolutely. Let me make a point. When I got to Washington, the healthcare system in America was broken. Costs were skyrocketing like crazy. People were worried that they couldn't pay their premiums next year. I went first to Newt Gingrich and then to Denny Hastert and said, we need to pass healthcare reform. We should do it by getting rid of the tax break for your, giving that tax break to you, letting you buy your own plan. Because, oh, by the way, people are smart enough to buy their own health plan. And when they do, they'll spend their money wisely and costs will come down. And they came back and said, nope, we can't do that issue. It's too big. Now we're shocked when we didn't fix the health care system that the Democrats did it in a way we don't like. Immigration reform is the same issue. We can do it now with the principles Republicans believe in. And if the president signs it, fine. If he doesn't sign it, fine. Or we can kick the can down the road and the Democrats will ultimately
do it. Now it's certainly 2015. It's not 2016.
It's 2015. It's before August.
And as you know, we just have a 1 hour slice of your Sunday evenings. We appreciate you spending it with us. Let's tie a bow around this when we come back right here in the Think Tank, KTAR News.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
Our guest is former Congressman John Shattuck. We are talking about the possibility of actually getting anything done in Washington other than gearing up for the next election. And I want to throw out to you kind of a proposition that was made by Dennis DeConcini on this show a few months ago. And I'm asking him the question, why can't we seem to get anything done? And he made what I think most people would say a very provocative statement. He said, you know, you get to almost getting a deal, and we've been there on many issues to almost seems to the edge. It can't quite get quite over the top. He said, you know, in the old days, you used to do it with earmarks. You bought the last few votes. I'm thinking of the movie Lincoln. This is not new stuff. Does that play a role? Is that we seem not to be able to get anywhere on anything?
Well, I was a passionate opponent of earmarks when I was in, and I remain an opponent of earmarks, but that does not mean that you can't buy votes. But buy not in the kind of crass commercial sense, but buy in the sense of compromise on each side. If there are, let's say, conservatives who don't want something to pass, but you treat them with respect and you say to them, okay, would you be willing to give and throw your vote for that if we will give you, then let them name what they want.
On a different issue?
On a different issue.
Because that's more than just compromise. To me, compromise is on that issue itself.
You need compromise on that issue. Yeah. Clearly, we have different views of the world, and you have to have compromise, and the compromise should settle toward the middle. What's good policy for America? And then go home and defend it, which is what Edmund Burke instructed legislators to do. But you also can do cross-legislation dealing where you say to different constituencies, hey, you're not going to win on that one, but you can win on this one. And then you make them identify their priorities and ask for the things they want. I would argue that that's exactly what Newt Gingrich worked to do. He paid attention to the moderates in our conference, the center of the conference, and to the conservatives in the conference. I would argue that's exactly what Denny Hastert did. You got to pay everybody respect, and then you got to come to a middle ground. And you can't necessarily always bring them to the same point on any one bill. And they have to understand, you know, the compromise is across the aisle on that bill where they don't get what they want.
Are there a lot of people currently elected, however, who think compromise is a dirty word? Is that some of the problem?
I don't think they're really given that choice. I think that you can look at Phil Gramm. Phil Gramm said, look, anything more than half a loaf and I get to fight and live to fight another day is where we ought to go. And I think a lot of people there in Congress, particularly on the House Republican side, at least looking at them, they're willing to do that if they trust that they will get treated fairly in the future. But I think kind of the contingent of conservatives that a lot of Americans look at and say, oh, poor John Boehner, he has to deal with him. I think he needs to earn their trust, because it's not just that they don't trust Barack Obama. It's that they aren't really willing to trust their own leadership. And I think that they will tell you good reason for not doing so.
I want to, before we leave here, we're the heating up of the presidential. We just finished an election, so of course a presidential election on its way. I wonder if you could sort of handicap, in light of the scheme that we've set out, that we've got the social conservatives, we've got in the Republican Party, I'm talking mm-hmm. now, the social conservatives, the economic conservatives, and you suggested there's a third group as well. How do the candidates play out to this?
Well, I think that
or my big question is, can Jeb Bush co-opt the whole thing? Can he do what his brother did?
You know, I tell people that they ask politicians those kind of questions all the time. What people don't know is that they actually give you a crystal ball when you get with your election certificate.
Yeah.
But they take it away when you leave. So my big question is, can Jeb Bush bring people around and get them to coalesce behind him? I think there are some other people out there that might be able to do it. I was on the budget committee under now Governor John Kasich of Ohio. He is too moderate for lots of people, but I think
on the social side more than the economic side, right?
Absolutely. On the economic side, he's very conservative, but I think he can do well. I think clearly at some point in the future, Marco Rubio is a talented leader who could come forward. I think the decision of Romney to step out was a very good decision, not because he wouldn't have been a good president, because he's not electable. He's created the impression that the Republican Party is the party of fat, white, rich men. And that's a hard
image for him to share.
How would Bush change that, though? He's a rich white man.
I don't,
from the old guard, by the way. We're staring down the barrel of another Bush-Clinton election here. So this is a lot for a lot of Americans to swallow.
I think Bush is very different than Romney. Bush has never done anything as stupid and singularly definitive as standing up and saying, I don't care what 47% of the people think. And sometimes the truth comes out in remarks. And whether Romney believes that deeply or not, he said it and people go, yeah, I got it.
You're done. Video.
On. Yeah. And he also, I think you have to look at Bush. You have to recognize he comes from a family that does look forward. In Texas, they have been pro-Hispanic from day one. He himself is fluent in Spanish, married to an Hispanic woman. He can, I think, bridge a gap. To me, I don't know the ages of the two men, but to me, Bush comes across as younger than Romney. And he also hasn't had multiple shots. I think there is a chance.
He wisely sat out last time.
Wisely sat out last time.
Because that would have been just too soon.
Yep.
He's got a hold on Florida. He does have a hold on Florida.
He has a very strong hold on Florida. And, yeah. and he brings an energy to the fight and an intellect to the fight. Now, but he's obviously made some mistakes.
And he may have some immigration issues with a lot of the Republican Party.
The question is, how much of the Republican Party and what are the immigration issues? Again, I think you can write an immigration reform bill that the vast majority of Republicans say, yeah, that's right. As a matter of fact, I think it is impossible to secure the border by just building a Berlin Wall. And I think if you say, well, wait a minute, let's be prudent about this.
But there
this.
Are folks who don't want to hear that.
No, there are.
They want a military-only solution.
But I think those are the small. You brought this up earlier. You said that this was, you know, that they do not want, anyone running for office does not want that small group, the 3-4% that'll scream and holler I think those, the 3-4%, are the ones that are screaming for a Berlin Wall. I don't think the majority of Americans want anything like that.
I completely agree with that. And as soon as someone steps forward with a bill that is balanced, which I would argue the Senate bill last year was not, then that group will get quiet real quick.
They're going to start screaming amnesty.
Well, they scream amnesty at everything, yeah. But if there are three of them versus 97 of the others, and I think the other thing
it seems to me like it's a bigger group. The percentages, maybe they're incredibly skillful in the way they project themselves, but they sure seem a lot bigger than that.
It's because the target that has been drawn is big enough for them to shoot at, rather than being a skillfully crafted target. If you want to talk about what the House Republicans should have done last year, is they should have passed a bill defining what Republicans actually believe, at least thoughtful Republicans in Washington actually believe about immigration
with America
reform.
Too.
Well, my view was on immigration reform, but you know, this whole sense. Reagan's legislation was an amnesty. If you define amnesty as
Reagan was amnesty because it included not only letting you in, but it included a path to citizenship.
If the definition is any penalty, the definition I think of amnesty legally is any penalty other than that which exists in the current law. So by definition, there will be some form of amnesty. The question is, what's good policy for America? Is it good policy for America to have people coming in? We don't know who they are. We can't find them when they break the law. They live in communities where the locals around them won't turn them in because they're afraid they will be kicked out of the country.
And therefore won't cooperate with the police on other matters because they're scared to death of a policeman in their neighborhood.
And who, history shows, will not take American jobs from Americans. The statistics show it right now. The number of Americans who want to handle a number of the jobs in this economy are jobs like mucking out pens for horses or cattle.
I remember when John McCain said, okay, $50 an hour. We got a job picking lettuce in Yuma. Who wants it? 120 degrees. No takers.
Talk to the people in those economies, and they'll tell you that when they hire American-born workers, they work for less than a day and say, no, this job's too hard for me. That's a broad generalization. But
it's a broad generalization, but generally true. It is.
We can
back-breaking work.
Right,
a lot
right,
of that.
But most of us
ask yourself, we have invested millions, and we're being told we should invest tens and tens of billions in educating the American people, and then we're surprised to learn that once we've educated them, they don't want to wash dishes all day.
Well, they don't want to wash dishes all day because those nets are there. They can go on 99 weeks of unemployment. They can have their food with the EBT cards. They can have it. They don't need to go. We don't need to go do that. Until that net is gone or until it's substantially reined in, they're never going to want to do any of those.
Well, I think also there's a difference between agricultural work, which is backbreaking, and dishwashing. You know, that
There's some differences.
Yeah, I mean, some of that agriculture stuff is just beyond anybody who once you become accustomed to living indoors.
The other important thing is to think about exporting those jobs. We'd rather have the jobs shipped overseas so we don't grow our own food.
Come back and visit us again, will you? This was
Anytime.
Great. We had a great time. On behalf of Doc O'Neill and the Think Tank crew, I'm Mike Russell. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah.